Now entering Nerdist.com.
It's the Nerdist Writers Panel on the Nerdist Podcast Channel. Ben Blacker talking writing with writers. Writers talking writing
can get pretty exciting.
The talk can be enlightening.
It's very rarely frightening.
Ben Blacker talking writing with writers.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Nerdist Writer Series. Yeah, yeah. All right. All right. Condescending applause. Welcome to the Nerdist Writing Series, an informal chat about television writing and the business of writing television. My name is Ben Blacker. I'm the co-creator of the Thrilling Adventure Hour, a stage show in the style of old-time radio. For more information, go to thrillingadventurehour.com. Let's get right to it. Let me introduce you to our panelists. First up, I forgot to fact-check this before. She's written on a whole lot of series in the last...
Several years.
Including The Middleman, The Unusuals, and Standoff. She's currently a writer on NBC's Parenthood. Please welcome Sarah Watson. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to this.
Thank you all for coming out.
You're right.
I'll thank all of you personally later.
How will you get through them all?
That sounded dirty.
Our next panelist is a writer, director, and producer. His TV credits include the series The Black Donnellys, The Shield, and The Unusuals. He wrote and directed the 2006 feature film 45, which starred Mila Jovovich. Most recently, he served as a writer and producer on the FX series Justified. Please welcome Gary Lennon. Coming this way.
Oh, yes.
This guy has written and produced over a dozen TV series, including Dream On, Third Rock from the Sun, The Simpsons, Grounded for Life, and Samantha Who? During the most recent writer's strike, he made a series of popular web videos, which led to a deal with Sony whereby he would write, produce, and star in his own internet talk show, which they're around five minutes long. They're totally charming and funny. Go check them out. They're called Anytime with Bob Cushell. They can be seen on Crackle.com. Bob Cushell is this guy. Hi, Bob.
Hey. It's like a really good camp where there's like one counselor for every four campers.
It's like a
very
camp
very good
for
special
kids. We got a lot of state
funding. Nice.
That's a perfect segue to Parenthood.
What?
Never mind. I made a really bad joke.
Thank God we talked over it. And our final panelist, who looks terrified back there. The back door is locked. Good luck. Our final panelist has a background in journalism, which she can tell us about making that jump. And she also has done some directing and documentary, as well as short narrative features in film and TV. She was a writer and executive producer on the hit CBS procedural Cold Case. Currently, she is the creator and developer and the executive producer of AMC's hit show, The Killing. Veena Sood is here.
Thank you.
Hi, you guys. Thanks for being here. I really do appreciate it. We're going to have a great little chat today. What I'd like to start with, as I always find it instructive, though everyone has a different story for this, is how you guys broke into the television industry, whether or not that was your initial goal. Did you set out to write for television or for something else? And what the process of breaking in was. And Sarah, let's start with you.
For me, I did not know this is what I wanted to do. I was at UCLA studying English, and I thought I wanted to be a teacher and save the world and write the great American novel in the summertime. And then a film class seemed like a really good, easy way to fill an elective, because UCLA has like a really big movie theater on campus. So I was like, oh, I'll go watch movies and get 4 credits. And I really dug it, and Going to UCLA, I was able to get an internship and read a shitload of scripts and wrote coverage on them, and then worked as a writer's assistant on a kid's show, and somehow from that was able to get staffed onto an FBI hostage procedural. I think that's, you know, really for a lot of people, that's the natural progression, is to go from Disney Channel to hostage procedural.
Let's back up a little bit before I forget about that. What was the kid's show, and really, do you know what got you onto
Yeah, my agent told me that I had to write a dark sample or I was going to be writing kid shit forever.
So you wrote an original
sample? Yeah, I wrote an original sample. I wrote an original pilot spec that wasn't even really that dark, but it was just darker than... I tend to write much softer character stuff, and I love genre stuff. So those are sort of like... That's what's in my wheelhouse. So I went as dark as I could, and it got me into the procedural world. And then from there, Lipstick Jungle, because that's the other natural progression, is generally to go from, you know, a hostage procedural to a Candace Bushnell series starring Brooke
What's
Shields.
What's next?
Yeah.
We'll go through the entire resume as we go on.
Let's not.
Because but there is an insane progression.
Oh, yeah.
It.
It's insanity, for sure.
And we'll get to it. Okay. Gary, what about you?
I lived in New York. I grew up in New York, and as a kid, I wanted to be an actor, and that wasn't sort of in my trajectory. I studied with really great people like Geraldine Page and the Neighborhood Playhouse, Richard Pinner, and I wasn't getting any work. And so I started writing stuff for myself, and I started producing it with another friend of mine, a girl named Kelly Kane. We started a theater company, and honestly, I was very fortunate. I just was, I was sort of ignorant and didn't know. I didn't even graduate high school. I had my background, Sarah knows, is insane. My parents both passed away by the time I was 11, and I was sort of on the street and didn't know how I made it where I made it. But ultimately what I did was I started writing that experience. And that's what I encourage all of you to do. If you really, I think it's the greatest way to get from just writer to creator is to write what separates you from the pack, what you know. And so when people read it, they go, this is the only thing that this person could write. Wow. And basically reveal yourself in the writing. And so that's what I did. I wrote a play called Rated X. And then it was about kids on the street. And I was very fortunate. And I was literally at the gym one day. And I was coming down in an elevator. I brought a towel around my neck. Exactly. And this producer said, wow, that's a provocative title. And I was like, how you doing? And he was like, yeah. And ultimately they came to see the play. And I got my first job writing a movie for HBO, and I was like, wow, I can't even believe this. And I honestly got paid to do what I do before I knew what I was doing. And fortunately, I hung in there and got better. But that was my journey. I became a playwright, and then I sold a number of my plays as films. I spent about 10 years in the film business and sold lots of movies. And then about 5 years ago, started writing TV, and I've been very fortunate. And that's it. Hmm.
Interesting. And we'll go a little deeper as we move on. But Bob, how about you?
I always seemed to know that I wanted to be a writer. I thought it was a director when I was in second grade. I was writing things to direct, but I didn't know I was writing them. That's what I was. And when I was in college, I had my own comedy group in Los Angeles. And I got an agent when I was 19 years old, and they said that, you know, look, you're 19 years old, you're a junior in college, this is not going to happen for months, or I mean years. You have to graduate and do whatever. And within 6 months, I was writing for non-guild shows on Fox, and it was just kind of a crazy time. And I was there for 8 months at Fox. I chose to go there over being on staff at Nickelodeon because I always wanted to go through the gate of a movie studio. I thought that was the most incredible thing in the world. And then I did animation for Disney and Hanna-Barbera. And then I went back to school. I finished up my degree and I came out and I got my, what I like to say is my first like real agent, who was Chris Silberman. We were both 23 years old, and now he's the president of ICM. It's just crazy. My journey in sitcoms was I started on Dream On, and it just has gone for the last 20 years. It's been very fortunate, very lucky career.
That's great. Let me just step back a little bit. And what was, you were kind of thrown in, right, as a 19-year-old, and you had writing in your background.
Yeah.
But were you prepared for the structures and the strictures of writing for television?
I think so, because I'd it was like I was so obsessive about it. It's like it's one of those things where it's like if it's just not in your blood, don't do it because there's ways to get a job that are much easier. So it was just always I was always reading about it. I was always writing. So when I got there, it felt like, and I had written. I think I had written in college 12 spec scripts for shows. So it was just like. I knew the form. I knew the format. So when I got onto Dream On when I was 22, it's like I felt like I knew what I was doing. It was, I think that's the thing. You've just got to keep doing it. Keep doing it. You know.
Absolutely. Vina, what about you? Tell us about your background.
I lived in New York for many years. I went to undergrad there, and then I went to grad film school in New York as well. And when I got out, I got really lucky. I got a directing gig for The Real World, and it was exciting for about 5 months, and then it quickly was not. And I realized, I was just like, I'm going to slit my throat if I have to do this for the rest of my life. And I had met Tom Fontana when I graduated from NYU, and he did Homicide and Oz was on at the time, and I was a huge rabid Oz fan. So trying to impress Tom, who had looked at my directing reel, I was kind of like, I'm going to write an Oz spec, having never written a television spec. And I didn't even know that there were act breaks. I didn't know anything. I was just like, wah, wah, wah. You know, the whole thing, like one long thing. And you usually don't do that because the showrunner or the creator knows the show so well that you should try to write something else because you will inevitably fail. But what it did for me was just make me fall in love with television. And I had the Oz spec, and I heard about this thing called the Disney Fellowship in LA, and sent the Oz thing in. And very quickly they said, move out here and we'll start, you know, potentially get you on a show. So I came out and got on Push Nevada, which was a great experience because I'd been so used to being alone, you know, as a writer, just writing and trying to get people to read it. No one would read your stuff. And to be in a writer's room was just amazing with really smart people. And then the show got canceled. Then I got on Cold Case and was on the show for 5 years and then created The Killing.
Do you guys remember Push Nevada? You guys remember this show? Tell them a little bit about that, because that was your first experience, and yeah. I have to imagine it was a little unusual,
yes.
Was it not?
It was unusual. I mean, it was a show that was ahead of its time. It was almost like Lost, like there was a mystery wrapped in an enigma in this strange little town in Nevada, and nobody was what they seemed, and it was very strange. But the experience itself was amazing, because there were phenomenal writers. Jim Parriott was running the room, Sean Bailey's show, and Joan Rader, Tony Phelan, Sean Whitesell, who was an Oz writer, just all these like star writers were there, and here was I, the little baby from the Disney program, just, you know, like a sponge, just learning everything from them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And Sarah, you also walked into, were you a full writer on your Nickelodeon show, or
oh,
were you
on
an
Disney
assistant?
Channel? No, I was a writer's assistant, and I wrote to, they, you know, let the writer's assistants write a couple
so
of
episodes. What was making the leap to the staff writer like?
Well, it was strange because it was I worked for a Disney Channel show, which was a sitcom, essentially, and I wanted to do drama. That was sort of like my dirty little secret, but I really wanted to be a writer's assistant. So when I went in and interviewed for the job, I was like, oh yeah, sitcom is what I want to do. And then like, you know, I'd be like at my desk between like on breaks, like working on my like 6 feet under spec and like not telling anybody about it. And so it was a great experience. Working on a Disney Channel show is sort of like getting to be in like a sitcom room in the 80s, but like totally safe, because it's like all the like big writers who were like at the top of the world in like when sitcoms were, you know, prevalent and everywhere, are a lot of them are now doing Disney Channel shows because there aren't as many sitcoms, although it does seem to be swinging a little bit now. So it was sort of like getting the like best experience with these like great sitcom writers, but not in like a crazy like, you know, the pressure of like being in Roseanne's room, and which I got to hear many fun stories, and I'm glad I didn't have to be in that room. Yeah. And, you know, and so when I went to a 1 hour drama, I went from, you know, that to my first network show was, you know, it was nine there were 9 of us on staff, 8 men, me, who really only had, you know, kid show experience and had to, and we didn't have much of a room on standoff. We had a little bit of one, but I was really thrown in and on my own, and I had to go in there and be like, yeah, I can do this. So it was, you know, I went from like training wheel Disneyland to like, okay, go write your script. And it was moderately terrifying. Thank you for asking.
Well, I'm going to bring you back to that. Would you, I just want to follow up on one thing. Would you say, and we talked about how you've been on a number of series,
yes,
over the years.
Many, many. I'm the Black one? Widow of network television.
But not anymore.
Not anymore. Yeah, I've not broken anymore. The streak.
Would you say there was a room that you were in that is sort of a typical room?
Typical would be, the middleman was probably the most functional. And that was probably the most typical. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Because that was really the first like phenomenally well-run show. Like I did a couple that were like decently run shows, but like that was the first one that the trains ran on time. It was creatively energizing. It's Javier Grigio-Marxwatch, who I know was on this panel a couple weeks ago. And he just ran a very creatively safe room. And so that was the kind of normal room, I guess what you're talking about, where like, you know, from 10 in the morning till 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night, we're just in there outlining stories, putting stuff up on the whiteboards and that kind of stuff.
Gary, I want to talk about the room on some of the series that you have worked on. And we have to talk about The Shield and Justified.
Yeah, absolutely.
These are shows where everything came together. Yeah. I'm rewatching both of them.
No,
they're
absolutely
so amazing. What were the rooms like on these shows?
I was very lucky because on The Shield, Sean Ryan is, you know, probably one of the best showrunners ever, and really gives people opportunities. I had never met Sean in my life. I had directed an indie movie, you know, 45 with Mila. Sean had seen the film. I was, you know, very fortunate. Again, we met. He was like, yeah, it's the last season. Do you want to write on the show? Did. I only had one TV job before that. I had sold pilots before that in development, but I had not, I only been on one other show, which was the Black Donnellys. Excuse me. And so when I went on The Shield, it really felt, and you know, that was an amazing show and I was a huge fan of it and all of that. And so going in and walking into those writers was very intimidating because I just thought all of them were brilliant, you know, and I thought I was going to walk into like a group of like Hell's Angels, you know, with like tattoos and they were just really smart, great people and fantastic writers. And like Vina, I felt very fortunate that I really felt I was able to absorb from them and learn about really crafting good TV. Because Sean is amazing at, you know, writing to act breaks, an amazing guy who he used to, you know, use a term to make things go sideways. And if you go into a room and you would break stories, you know, Adam Fierro was one of the guys who ran the room at the time. It was the last season, and he's a great writer. But we would, you know, create stories, and then Sean would come in, and he'd sort of mess them up. And I love one of the themes that Sean talks about, which is sort of like finding the gold in your mud, which is messy is good at times, you know? I mean, it can be really exciting. And I come from that kind of background, from messiness, so I just was absorbing everything on a fast pace. And it was great experience, and it was very, very much, ran really, really well by Adam. And then with Justified, again, Graham is a very different showrunner than Sean, but equally as good in the sense that, you know, I got on that show because I had written a spec. I sold another pilot to HBO, and Graham read that. We had a meeting, and then he hired me. And when we first got there, which was really cool, you know, the pilot had been shot, obviously, and the show was picked up. And what he was cool about was he was very open. There wasn't no sort of a preconceived notion. It was like the first year of a show where I was on the last season of The Shield, which everybody knew those characters so well. So, you know, you knew exactly what they were doing, really. They were doing with this show as a new writer to the show. We were able to really contribute to the storylines and craft characters and bring personal details of our own personal lives in those characters and sort of make them so we all felt a sense of ownership on them, those characters. You know, for example, the character of Boyd Crowder, which is Walton, is amazing, who was on The Shield as well. He actually was killed in the original pilot that they shot based on Elmore Leonard's, you know, novella. And we, you know, when we came in, we were like, that fucking character is amazing. What are you, fucking crazy? He's got to stay around. And so, you know, as a collective group, we made the decision. And then, you know, then it was really cool because we just started talking about, like, what if it was your show and what would you do? And as a result, it was a very, as Sarah said, a very sort of safe, free environment that you could really bring yourself to the table and contribute. And, you know, that doesn't mean everything you say is going to be great. It means you pitch out like 14 things and two are really stellar and they land. And so it was a great, it's a great group of writers. It was a lot of fun. And season two got even better, I think.
Believe it.
Yeah.
Thanks. Bob, we've had some comedy writers on these panels, but take us inside the comedy writers' room. How was your experience? Do you think it was typical of a sitcom writer?
Well, I've worked on so many shows and so many different shows, from animation with, I guess, The Simpsons and last year American Dad to, you know, single camera shows, which is the bulk of my career, and actually of course, you know, Third Rock from the Sun, which was my favorite place to be in my career.
Why is that?
Well, that was like college. I mean, there were all these guys and women from different places and you know, failed shows or bad experiences, and we were all kind of like beaten down and young. And we got there, and we were all of a sudden writing for Bonnie and Terry Turner, who were just such remarkable, talented, intelligent people who had created something with a very specific vision. But like you just said, that we all felt a part of creating that show too. There was definitely a part of all of us in the show. And it really was like college. And it was like college. I was a theater major, and it was incredible for me because literally we would go off, we would write scenes. There would be, you know, after a run through or something, we need to rewrite a scene. And I would go off with Christine Zander and Bill Martin and Mike Schiff, and we would come back in the room and we would act out the scene for Bonnie and Terry. I mean, this is how it was great. And this is what I thought comedy writer rooms should be. And they never have been since and never were previously. But it was incredible. And they would laugh, and then it was instant feedback. And then, you know, they would scribble some notes or go off and think about this. And it was like college. It was so much fun. And I really think that fun and that excitement came across in the show. It was also fun because it was a mid-season show. So we were working in a void where we didn't know how the grander audience was going to accept the show. It was just the people who had been coming in from, you know, groups that they find in Universal Studios to show up in the audience. And I think that I look back at those 13 episodes as probably the funnest time in my career, because we were creating things for an audience that didn't know what they were, what it was, didn't have any expectation, had maybe seen John Lithgow, but was not a household name, and certainly didn't know Kristen Johnson or French Stewart or Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And the reactions from that audience were so genuine and real. And if you look back on the DVDs in those first 13 episodes, when you hear the audience laugh, it's real laughter. And when you don't hear them laugh, we didn't sweeten it. It was like there were ebbs and flows. And then after the show aired, it was like the Beatles. The 14th episode, all of a sudden, everybody knew who it was and who these people were. And when they'd show up, people would get laughter for a look or a line that wasn't very funny or shouldn't have gotten the laugh it got. And it was not as gratifying because those first 13 episodes were real. It felt real. It felt like we were doing plays every week. And then once the Beatles were there and they could do anything, there was something that was lost, you know. But those 5 years were, without question, the best 5 years of my life in terms of writing. And otherwise, it really hasn't gotten better than it's actually left.
How would you compare writing for a show like that to like an animated show like The Simpsons or Family, American Dad?
I mean, it's. I'm very biased because The Simpsons at the time, it was, you know, it's so funny because it was, I was there for the fifth and sixth seasons, which on most shows were the end of the run. And that was really just day one of The Simpsons. It was the holy grail to me to be there. I had written previously two Simpsons specs. I wrote a Simpsons spec. I was working at Fox when I was 20, and they were just writing The Simpsons show at the time. And I would sneak into the executive office building and steal scripts that were marked literally confidential. And I wrote a script based on these scripts that were being written that nobody else had seen. And but when I got there, it's like, be careful what you wish for, because at that time it was not fun. It was not fun. And this dream of what The Simpsons was going to be like for me was a very depressing making place. And that's why going from there to Third Rock was like the, you know, heavens opened up for me.
What made it not fun?
You know, it's always the fish, you know, stinks from the head. And when you've got a wonderful executive producer who's running the show in a way that you like and you feel appreciated, but more than that, just good show running, not wasting the staff's time, keeping it on track, making it collaborative. It just felt like none of that was happening during those first 2 years. And it was a very difficult position. I was also this big drama geek from UC Irvine, and I was, you know, looking across the room at this group of Harvard Lampoon guys who individually were all, you know, truly nice guys. And as a whole, they were, I'm sure, nice guys, but it was like this block, this quiet, thoughtful, scientific block of people writing comedy. And it's just, that's not how I run. That's not how I am. It was a difficult 2 years.
Interesting.
Now, Vina, you were on Cold Case for 5 years.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What did you learn from working on that show? And you're running The Killing, right?
Yes.
What did you learn from working on that show and executive producing that show that you could bring to running The Killing?
You know what? It's, just running a show is just, it's very managerial. So it was on Cold Case, it was just being able to, when Meredith left and wanted me to run the show, it was just stepping back and having to look at the big picture and looking at all the trains running on time, hopefully. So it's like it just became very managerial. But then at the same time, you know, and it had already been created by Meredith. So the characters were there, and I was coming in and running it in year four. And it's a procedural, so there's a certain format. So it was a great experience just to kind of learn those skills. It's totally overwhelming, but you know, it was fine. And then to be able to then go on to my own show and already have a lot of those skills learned, and then just, it really freed me just to be like, now we've got this block of time in the room, let's just run with these ideas. What do you guys think? Let's, you know, let's just play, you know, while we can. Because that train, that bullet train of production, mm-hmm. is coming right at us. But we got this time, so keep it sacred. Let's, you know, blah, 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 blah.
Well, when you're thrown into that showrunner's chair, and maybe we can take this apart just a little bit, what are the things you need to consider? What was the learning curve like for you? And what, you know, what are the trains?
Yeah, I mean, the trains are, really generally, there's... with a show that's just kind of coming up on its feet, there's pre-production. So there's all the mechanics of, you know, casting, hiring everybody from the cinematographer, you know, on down to building sets. What do sets look like? Are they camera friendly? Oh my God, they're not. You know, pull that motherfucking wall down. We've got 2 days. You know, how did this get? You know, there's inevitable mistakes in pre-production. And then at the same time, simultaneously, you've hired all your writers and you're breaking story. And it's deeply, I mean, that is the most important point, you know, in a show, is creating the whole arc of the series. And so you're trying to do that, like it's multiple hats. Mm-hmm. So then, you know, then you start shooting and all hell breaks loose. You know, you realize, oh my God, there's not enough hours in a day, and this director's not working, and what happened, you know, this person's having a meltdown. And so there's a lot of just juggling. And then you've got scripts, and they have to be, everyone's giving you notes on the scripts. So yeah, it's just a lot of that. And then here comes post. Now you have to start editing and going to color correction and going to, you know, mixing. And yeah, I'm glad a hiatus is starting right now for me.
Show running, it's not taught, you know, it's this thing where when you're a writer, you're writing because you're passionate about it, because you love what you're doing. Mostly it's you're alone. You're writing scripts or spec scripts or whatever, and then you get on staff and you're writing alone, and then with the group, whatever it is. But this show running thing, it's just a bitch. I mean, it's just, they don't teach you. They don't teach you how to manage. You have to be a manager of a staff. You have to be manager of a studio. You have to be a manager of a network and a crew. So you're managing four different companies at once. And the thing that I think matters most to you is the writing. You know, like you were just saying, you know, the writing. The writing is, that's why you got into it. But you're dealing with the emotions of this actress and the emotions of this writer and the emotions of this editor and the emotions of this idiot, you know, network person. And then all of a sudden you're, you know, it's just you're a therapist. And it's just, it's a lot of work. A lot of work.
And it, I would imagine it is in many ways antithetical to what a writer does. Everything. Where you just sit there.
Yeah, because
and
you're the neurotic mess, right. You know, and there's nobody there for you, you know. So I mean, that's really the problem. There's nobody there for you, and you're you know, in a fetal position on a couch yes. all the time.
Yeah.
So,
and while we're on the topic, you know, interviewing to get a job as a writer is also fairly antithetical to what it is to be a writer. You know, you have to go out and sell yourself a little bit. Vina, I would imagine you more recently than anyone else has hired a staff. Mm-hmm. What were you looking for?
I think, well, multiple things. I mean, the number one thing is a sample. You know, that's the biggest sell. And too many people make the mistake of not writing enough. So the the problem that I've run into is I'll read something original from somebody, like a short story, great thing to write, 10 pages, 20 pages versus like 120 if you guys are writers. Mm-hmm. Make sure everyone is really happy. and we can hear your voice pretty quickly. But then it's like, do they have, they've submitted for a cop show, do they have a procedural? No. Well, what do they have? They have something else. And you just, you need more. You need, so like you said, the 12 scripts, like write your heart out, write like 15 things, write short stories, write plays, you know, one act play, you know, a procedural. I mean, you have to write what you love, but you gotta write. I mean, that's ultimately what you're going to be doing on staff, is writing all the motherfucking time. So there's no excuse now that you're, you know, that you're not staff to not have 15 scripts. And then, you know, once you're in the interview, just keep talking, like have solutions, you know, have ideas, you know, be enthusiastic, you know, and because that is ultimately what the room is people, like you said, pitching 15, 20, 25, 30 ideas a day and none of them going, you know, and then coming back the next day and not being hurt, but just being like, oh my God, what about this? And riffing off of other people. So those are, that's really important.
Well, being hurt, but still
yes,
doing that.
Not showing it, yes.
Definitely hurt. Devastated.
Vina, you're saying, you know, you have to write what you love on this original material. And Gary said a similar thing, you know, writing what you know. Now, Sarah.
Yes.
You're on Parenthood.
Mm-hmm. What?
How many kids do you have?
Zero.
Was there any trepidation on your part, on their part, when you came
Definitely
on board?
Definitely on their part. I think I was one of the last people hired on Parenthood, despite being, I think I was the very first writer to have a meeting there. Because Jason wanted to make sure he assembled a staff of people who actually knew about kids. I mean, my agent actually has two kids, and I said something to him about, I can't remember what it was, like something about, can't you just like drug them when you put them on, like, and then put them in like the overhead bin of the plane, because he was saying how hard it was to travel. And there was this pause. He's like, I got you on a show called Parenthood. But yeah, no, so I definitely think on the showrunner's part, Jason really wanted a staff of parents. But and so we do. But I, you know, I have emotions, I have a family, I have parents. So I do feel like I'm able to write that. You know, I wrote on a superhero show and I've never been a superhero. And I've also never been an FBI hostage negotiator. And I wrote the shit out of that one.
You could have my kids.
That's the other thing, is everyone offers their kids. They're like, oh, take mine for a day. You'll have a million stories. I'm like, no, thank you. I'll just read Fit Parenting magazine.
Gary, same question. Have you encountered on the shows that you've worked on that hurdle, you know, where you don't have an immediate association, you can't relate, you know, literally to the characters? How do you get through that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Vina that you should, I mean, there's no reason to not be writing if that's what you do, and have all kinds of, I mean, we have very different interests, right? I mean, when Graham was staffing for Justified, I didn't have a Western. I didn't have a script that took place in Appalachia. But what Graham looked at when he was staffing was, you know, your voice as a writer and your strengths. And I think when you're in that meeting and you're with the showrunner, I love going on a show that I'm passionate about, because I'm like one of those crazy people who loves work. Like I, you know, I'm like, I'm boom, 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 boom. I'm just like pitching my ass off. But the thing is that when they're reading you and they'll hear your voice, when you come in the room, it's like, have ideas about, and don't be afraid that you might have the wrong idea. I think that you just have to, you know, I think that when you embrace yourself 100% uncompromisingly and tell them who you are, they're either going to get you or they're not. And the great thing about being a writer is that we're not for everybody. And the sooner that you realize that, I think the easier it all is. It's just be yourself and you'll wind up where you're supposed to be. I mean, I actually, everything that I've ever written, my original material, my agent, I wrote a feature about an old Italian woman who's a bookie, because my mother was a bookie.
Great script.
And you know, my agent was like, why are you writing a fucking spec about a woman, like a 65-year-old woman who's a bookie and she books numbers with her grandson? And I was like, I have to write that script. Like, I really meant that, seriously. And it went out and everyone was like, oh God, it's fucking old lady and a kid. And then I sold it, you know, and it was so fulfilling to do that. So when you go into a room, you know, you might, like Graham and I, well, we guys are going to go sit at a bar and have a couple of beers. Probably not. But there's mutual interest. There's a common denominator, you know, and if you just are yourself and someone sees that, they're going to pick up and be like, I want to be around this person. They have some really fucking good ideas. You know, we might not like hang, but it's about translating your passion, you know. That's what I would recommend. And I really do recommend, like Vina said, like I just wrote a play after not having written a play in 10 years. And TV, it was an incredible experience for me because TV is sometimes you feel a little handcuffed about what you can and cannot do. And I wrote a play that came out of nowhere and I'm excited about writing it, you know? I mean, I think that shows on the page is when you're excited about writing that thing, people see it, it's universal, you respond, you go, boom, oh shit, this person wrote that because they knew it and I feel it. And that's exciting. I know when I read specs and I read someone's material, I want them to educate me about who they are. And I love seeing a world that I've never known before. It'd be about horse racing or whatever, prostitution. I learned a little bit about that. No, but you know what I mean. It's just about getting the thing that you're really excited about. Anyway.
Gotcha. Bob, how do you do that? How do you do that? Were you able to put yourself in any of these series that you?
Oh, absolutely every single one of them.
How I mean, so? Give us some examples.
Dick Solomon was me. At that time, maybe, I don't know, but I mean, John Lithgow looking at himself, just going, "I'm gorgeous." I mean, that's me as a joke, but it's me in reality. I mean, it's just me. It's just like thinking you're so great, but then thinking you're just the worst in the world, and just all of that stuff and the way they looked at life. I mean, I still feel like I look at life like a little kid. I still feel like I'm a staff writer. I still feel that way. I think that is so much fun. I mean, I get excited. I'm like excited about this world still. I still want to put a show on in the barn. I mean, I did with my talk show. That was putting a show on in a garage. I mean, that was fun for me. And I really, their excitement about life and all of that stuff, I think that resembled a lot of what I am. And I gave a lot. I gave everything I had to that show. I mean, you were just saying about writing, you know, original material. I sat down a couple of years ago. I said to my agent, I said, what do you think I should do now? I mean, where am I? What am I? He said, you should write a dark comedy. And I immediately sat down and wrote a script that now is just paying off and they're going to make it at the BBC.
Whoa,
I just found out last week.
That's
yeah,
awesome.
Very excited. Really? About three guys who start a business of assisted suicide.
God.
It's called...
Whoa,
yeah.
It's a feel-good show.
Yes, it is. Right. And
it's called
Way to Go.
Awesome.
Yeah. Nice. So I'm so excited. I mean, I did it because, you know, did I want to transition into cable comedy or whatever? I needed something. And I just sat down and did it. It just came out, you know, and it's worked, you know?
Okay.
Yeah.
And Vina, the same question. I'm curious, especially about something like Cold Case, which is very procedural. Were you able to put yourself as a writer in this show?
Yeah, I mean, it's across the board what everyone's saying. Just I found the thing that I love. And it wasn't like, oh, I want a job on the show, so I'm going to write it. I was already writing dark murder, homicide, dead children under the basement stairs. I mean, I was just attracted to that material from day one. And ironically, my agent had said, and this was an agent in New York who didn't really know the industry way back when I was still doing reality television. And she said, I'd done an Oz spec because I, you know, wanted to write Oz. And she's like, oh my God, that's so dark. That's so dark. And like, no one's going to want to read that. And can't you write a comedy and can't you lighten up? And I was like, really? And she's like, yeah, people want to see versatility. No one wants dark. Like, the world is changing, and you shouldn't do that. And I said, okay, so, you know, Sex in the City, like, and that's not me, and I tried to write, and it sucked. And the Oz thing went out, and that was what everybody was responding to. And it was, and I would walk in, and people would be like, you wrote that spec. Holy shit. I mean, it was really, and it was really, like, not, it was like Oz times 10. Like, I even went, like, really far. And Meredith read it, and she was like, holy shit. She's like, awesome, come write for Cold Case. And so it's just like, right, you know.
And that's
like
so
said,
funny, because I had the exact opposite thing where everyone was saying to me, write dark, write dark, write dark. And I wrote this Gilmore Girls spec because I love the Gilmore Girls, and that's what got me on Parenthood.
Well,
and it's
something.
like a 7-year-old spec. Mm. I think Rory was applying to college in my spec. Yeah, so it is. Yeah. It's write what you love and what you know. And I think even if you're not writing a situation that you know about personally, you're bringing your emotions to it. Don't try to fake the emotions. You can fake the situations. You can do all the research about any world you want, but you're not going to be able to fake the emotions.
I want to ask, I only have a couple more questions, so I hope you guys are ready with questions. But I want to ask again, Bob and Bina, just because you guys have worked on these shows that, again, especially Cold Case and so many sitcoms too, which are, I don't want to say they can get samey, but, you know,
sure.
You have to have a lot of plot in those kinds of shows, whereas something like Justified or The Shield or Parenthood, or, yeah, there's a mythology and it's very emotionally driven. What drives story? Where does it come from? How do you, when you all get in the room and the stories start coming out of everyone?
What literally drives it, or what keeps the writer getting it up every day for the same
thing? The second one and then the first one.
Okay. The second one, again, if you can find the thing that you love, like all the writers would come in at the beginning of the season on Cold Case and be like, I just read this article in the New Yorker about some blind girl who stabbed her, you know, her mother. And it's such a great article because da-da-da-da-da, and it's about a child being, you know, manipulated by her parents. And so you would just come in with like 10 really good things that you were deeply passionate about. And even though the format was hugely plot-driven and you had to write to the act break and it was just plot and it was not character except for the dead person, you were excited about the material. So that was fun. And then what drove Cold Case in particular was it was the same format. So there was not I mean, it was more challenging to do a serialized show because you aren't in, you know, you aren't kind of going lockstep with, you know, with a procedural. It's like there's 3 flashbacks in each act, and there's the discovery of the thing, and then he turns and they turn, and this, blah, blah, blah. You know, so that's how it went.
And Bob, what about, you know, finding material to be funny?
I just opened that big book of what other people did on television and just do that show for the other show. No, I think it comes from the same place as dramas, the news, what's going on in your life. It's all the same stuff. They just view it through a different prism, and we just view it through a different prism. I can't remember. I know breaking stories, but, and I think that's one of my, the thing, one of my strengths is breaking stories, but I can't picture really where stories come from. I mean, I've never been on a staff where you go, bring in 30 ideas tomorrow. It just comes from the talking and, oh, that would be good. And I got an idea for this one, you know, a one-liner about, you know, whatever it is. And it just keeps going and then building and building and building. I just, I think if I had to sit down and go, I always hate doing that. I always hate coming up with 5 story ideas. I love sitting around with a staff and it just comes naturally. I kind of envy a show though that has a mythology because it just feels like you've got somewhere to go as opposed to having these, you know, things that have to wrap up at the end of every episode and everybody has to be back to where they were. And that's what's, and I hope, and I think comedy's kind of moving away from that a little. You know, I think Friends started sort of a mythology and you know, a non-linear storytelling. Is that right? Is that the word? Not non-linear. Non-ending. I don't know how to write. I don't know how to talk.
But having those long story arcs in a
yes,
comedy.
Long, yeah. That's what I was thinking. Arcs.
Yeah, definitely. And let's talk about the shows that do deal with the mythologies and the histories of the characters and that are emotionally driven. Are these stories derived the same way, would you say?
I think, you know, I mean, for Justified, it, you know, at the beginning of the year when we came in and we talk about the characters and, you know, generally, sometimes, I think both years in a row, actually, we didn't actually know exactly where our main characters are going to go. But they're a signpost. You know, we have big moves, like three or four really big moves, and we know we got to get there. And the route there will take different changes. It's just like when you're writing your script. You know what the midpoint is, you know what your act break is, you know. But the way that you get there is where the meat is, where the gold is, where the fun is, really. And so we all talk about, I mean, I think in this show, which was really great experience, is that, you know, we all talked about our own personal lives and then brought that to the characters. And what you just said is the most fun in the writer's room. And I think that's why, I like the writer's room. And you have a lot of fun. You talk about each other's lives and then you start piecing and be like, oh my God, I love that. You did that with your wife? Yeah. That's fucking crazy. And then you bring that in and you use it and you see it and it sort of reveals itself. And even thematically, a theme will resonate out of all the storytelling, and you go, okay, the second season is about second chances. Bam, that's it. It's not like you write on the board second chances and then you build to that. It sort of reveals itself. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for example, in the second year of Justified, you know, when Boyd gets together with Ava, at first, when that was first pitched out, there was like a lot of reaction to like, oh my God, that can't happen. We have to protect the character of Ava. And would we like her if she does that? And I remember like pitching that out and hearing like, oh my God, that makes my stomach uncomfortable. Like the idea that she would wind up with him. And they were like, oh, sort of like that, you know? Yeah. And then you go, and then you really embrace that. And then you build to the end on that. So, you know where your character going sort of, or at least you talk with your showrunner about, it's his vision of the show. I mean, ultimately, Vina is the vision of The Killing. Graham Yost is the vision of Justified. But you have all these helpers sort of help you get there. And I think it's a lot of fun.
Interesting. Has that been your experience on Parenthood?
Absolutely on Parenthood. I mean, that shit is 100% ripped out of our lives. Like, I mean, stories that actually happen to people. I mean, I survived some of the marriages of my fellow writers have lasted. But, you know, especially a lot of the stuff with Max, the son with Asperger's, you know, Jason, who created the show, has an autistic son. And so many of those stories just come from small moments in his life. Some of them he doesn't even bring up as stories. He'll just be talking about this happened. And we'll be like, is it terrible if we use that? And, you know, working in the Parenthood writer's room, it's been like no other writer's room I've worked in, because it is like group therapy. I mean, we've dubbed it Cry a Lot Wednesdays, because somebody ends up in tears on a Wednesday being like, and then my father, you know, and it's just, it's that kind of show where, you know, you just really open up and bleed on the page. And some of the I've shared things in the Parenthood writer's room that it's my best friends don't know. It's really kind of insane and sick. And some of the stuff, it's funny because I haven't even realized lines I've written are things that come out of my life. Because, like, my dad was watching one of the episodes. He's like, I said that. I was like, oh, crap.
So he got credit on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now he wants shared credit, and it's like this WTA arbitration thing, and there's lawyers involved. And
let's talk for a minute. Gary, you were saying earlier that you just got done developing your own material. Tell us about that process. How was it for you?
You know, I love it. I mean, that's ultimately, I think we all want our own show, you know, and it's okay to be on staff and be in service of someone else's vision. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I mean, we want to tell our own stories. And I've been very lucky in the sense of setting up a pilot almost every year in the last 5 years or two even. And I mean, basically, it all starts with, what do you want to write about? What are you feeling? And then, you know, what you do is during development season, you partner with somebody, a producer or a studio. And you start riffing about ideas, you know, what do you want to write about? I love your freaking BBC thing, though. Like, I'm like all over that. I love it. But yeah, it's very cool. But, you know, you just start, and it's fun. Like, you develop with Nancy Cotton and Dave. And what's exciting, you go into these rooms with people and you start talking and they go, that's cool. I like that. And you start building. I just developed with my producers on Justified, Sarah Timmerman and Carl Beverly. We set up a pilot together at CBS. And they said, you know, Gary, we want to do a female cop show with you. And I come from, my parents were criminals. My brother was a dealer. One of them committed suicide, blah, blah, craziness. And so they were like, I was like, but CBS? And ultimately, though, I did my version of that story in CBS. And what I did was I created a character, female, that I completely identified with and I loved, but who had a criminal parent, you know, family. Her father was serving time in prison. Her brother was just getting out of prison. He was moving in with her. She was getting a divorce and she was just promoted. you know, great character, I think, you know, complicated, you know, flawed. And then implementing the procedural on that, because CBS is pretty much all procedural, you know. And that's not really, really where I go like, oh, my God, I can't wait to get up in the morning and find out that the butler did it. You know? I did my version of that, and I had a great time this year developing there. And I wrote a procedural that I really liked. And I'm that was, you know, that's that kind of experience. Last year, I sold a pilot to HBO that was about really my mom. I was about a woman whose husband's a criminal, dies in the pilot, and she sort of, it was sort of Ma Barker. I don't know if you know Ma Barker's story, but it was a woman who used her children as her henchmen and sort of developed a crime family through that. But it was seen sort of, the way I sold it was, I said, I sold them the first three seasons. I said, this is it. The first season is Hamlet seen through the eyes of Olivia. The segment, Olivia being Tony Soprano's mom. And then the second season is sort of King Lear. You know, they've built an empire now. How am I going to disperse the wealth? And the third season is Medea. There's a child. One of the sons has gotten, he's become a weakness and a cancer to the family. We have to take him out. And, but I love, I can't even tell you how much I loved that show. And, right?
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, it was great.
And it's my favorite script ever. Please, someone do it. And, you know, when I can tell you this, all of you, if you walk into a room and you don't really love the show that you're pitching, it's dead.
Yeah.
Dead. But if you fucking wake up and you cannot wait to tell someone this story, like when I'm going out pitching, I talk to a cab driver because I do not drive. I talk to people I'm hiking with. I talk to everyone about it so that by the time I walk in the room, it's not like a rehearsed monologue or something. It's like I cannot wait to share the story with you. And they feel that, and then they pay you to write it. And it's a joy, literally.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah, that's a great way to put it. It's a story you have to tell, and you do tell over and over. Yeah,
right?
That's really valuable. Bob, what has your experience with development been?
This year, it's so funny because I think I've written 12 pilots and nothing has gotten made. I wrote three this year. I wrote a pilot for Fox, which was a animated show basically about my life growing up in the Valley. I wrote a 1-hour drama, my first drama, starring Idina Menzel for ABC, and I wrote a half-hour multi-camera comedy for NBC. And you know, I believe that there is a life for what you just pitched, which is just so fantastic. Because what happened was they were all passed on. But within 3 hours after ABC passing on the Idina Menzel drama, ABC Family wanted it. And
wow.
I think we're going to be making that in November. And then a couple months after NBC passed on my comedy, I got a call from Tracy Katsky at Nick at Night, who is going to be producing half-hour multicams. And looks like they're trying to make a deal for that now. And then with Way to Go, all of a sudden it's like an embarrassment of riches, which is, it's crazy, but it rains a porous. It's been wonderful. But it's just that writing, you know, it's like every year when the pilot or two pilots that I write get passed on, I turn to my wife and I say, I can't do this anymore. It's over. Yeah. I can't do this again. And she goes, yeah, bullshit. You know, and then I do it again. And it's like, you know, Insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. But it looks like finally I'm getting some different results. So it's, I guess I'm not so insane.
Well, not because of that.
No.
That's amazing. Vina, tell us briefly about developing The Killing.
I was in the middle. I had just left Cold Case, and I knew I wanted to do something very dark and for cable and character-driven and with a mythology versus a procedural. And my agent told me about this Danish format, and she said it's called The Killing. And immediately I was just like, oh, my God, I got to watch it. And I watched the first three episodes, fell in love with it, and said, I have to do this. So basically I started with Fuse and just came up with a dorky 50 cards. You know, this is the character, this is the world, this is what happens, you know, and then this is how we're going to riff off of the original Danish series, and this is what we're going to do differently with the family. And then it was just jumping over hurdles. It was Fuse and I kind of, we knew we wanted it to be at AMC. So immediately that was the first place I pitched. And within about 3 weeks, they bought it. And it was really exciting. We knew we were going to go to pilot. And then that bullet train just started. And it was really fast and furious. And It was better than Network, from what I've heard, because Network is like a month turnaround for pilots. And we had about 2.5 to 3 months where we had to cast and hire and figure out where to shoot and figure out what the look was and who the director was. And it was, it's just a matter of when you get to that point and you're gearing up to shoot the baby that you are just about to have with like 1,000 other people. It's just falling in love, you know. It was constantly what I heard over and over was just follow your gut. So when Patty came in, Patty Jenkins, who directed Monster, and she was in the running for directing the pilot, and she'd never directed a television pilot, and this pilot was huge. It was gigantic. She came in and she talked, and we sat there for like 4 hours, and she walked out the door, and we had met with everybody in town before then, and I knew she was the one. And I was like, oh my God, this is terrifying. And again, because she had never done a pilot, it was humongous. And just went with Patty. And that was, again, it was just do what you love, follow your gut, follow what you think is best. Because the number one thing is when you're about to shoot the pilot, when you're going to series, everyone's got an opinion, you know, from the network all the way down. And all those opinions can be very, very valid. But ultimately, you know, you've got to remember like what, and I read somewhere, someone sent me a letter that a showrunner way back in the day, I'm so bad, creator of MASH,
Larry
would,
Gilmore.
Yes. And he said it was a letter that I think he wrote himself at the beginning of when he would create something. And it was, remember, this is your story. Remember, this is your vision. Invite everyone in who understands it and is on the page with you, and politely decline people who aren't, you know, with no maliciousness. They're not, it's just that everyone has an opinion of what will work and everyone's intentions are good. But you're not here, you know, as 10 chefs creating, sticking your fingers in the pot, because it would suck if that happened. But you really have to just be really clear and from the very beginning, before you get on that train, you know, who is this? Why am I writing this? What do I love about this? Just the essence, you know, within like one page, and put it away. And then when all hell breaks loose and everyone's telling you who the fucking character is, then you can open it up and be like, oh yeah, this is why I did this. This is, and if no one else likes it, Meredith Steen said a really important thing to me once. She said, you know what, if they don't like, and this was before Cold Case became a hit, she said, if they don't like it, then that's fine. But this is all I got. You know, this is me. And that's all I know. You know, so that was a really great piece of advice. Man.
While we're on the subject of advice, I've told the crowds, the massive crowds in the past, that my background is my writing partner and I have developed one or two scripts every year for the past 6 years for various entities. This year, we had had enough. And starting tomorrow, we have our first staff job. Congratulations.
Yeah.
that's enough. What advice do you have for me starting tomorrow?
Be nice to everybody, especially the support staff. Mm-hmm. Just be nice. Be nice and have a lot of
Did
ideas.
You learn that the hard way?
Yes, I was a raging bitch. And now that PA is running NBC.
I would say, yeah. I mean, your first day going in, it's like, it's, you know, it's really typical. It's first day at school. I mean, just do a good job. I mean, do your best. You know, really bring, don't be lazy. I mean, there are people who just feel entitled, you know, and they show up and they think being there is more than enough. That's not true. Be your best. You know, just bring your A game every time.
And I have to say, it's really easy to feel lazy because you feel like you worked so hard up until then.
Right. And I think sometimes this is I think some staff writers, when they get a job, they feel like, oh, well, since I'm the staff writer, I can sort of be quiet and lay back. And it depends on your showrunner. But if I've hired you to be a staff writer, I want to know what you think.
Say something.
You know, I mean, I remember actually on one show, there was a staff writer and the showrunner was like, what do you think, to the staff writer? And the staff writer was like, I think that's above my pay grade. And they were like, no. Your pay grade is tell me what you think. So, you know, I just think just really pay attention to
and
your
find a way to, if you're too intimidated to speak up, find a way to make yourself useful. I know a lot of staff writers who become the note card writer. Mm. Be that guy. Mm-hmm. Be the one who's up at the board doing all the, like, the stuff that nobody else wants to deal with and keeping everybody organized. Find some niche to keep yourself valuable. Because you are there to learn. But
absolutely. You know, also, I think that is don't be afraid to ask questions, because you know, your showrunner has a vision of the show, and if it's not articulated to you correctly, or you're not, for some reason, you're not speaking the same language, you know, ask. You know, say, I'm not sure I get that. Like, don't be intimidated that you have to know everything. They're not expecting that from you. We're all going to fuck up. Trust me. When you go to set your first time, you'll fuck up as well. But just don't be afraid to ask questions. You know, they want you to do well. They're paying you, you know, so.
Yeah. Listen a lot, too. Listen a lot. Get a feeling of the tenor of the room and what the dynamics of the room. I've been in so many rooms where a staff writer will come in and he or she will be completely antithetical to the style of the room. This, you know, especially a show that's been going on for so many years as Supernatural has. I think that it has its own dynamic. Am I wrong?
No.
Oh yeah. So I really think it's important to listen and to be of service in any way you can. But I, you know, sit back just a little bit, wait until you get a feeling, and then start, and then you can just run off like a train, you know?
Yeah, and listen to the music of the room, because it's like a group process, and you're all merging into one giant brain, and that brain exists already on that show because it's been around for a while. So I think exactly what you were saying, it's like one of the biggest mistakes I think sometimes staff writers make, and I made when I was younger, is that you say no, or the train is going and the music's starting, and you're like, but... Well, you know, like, and so just understand riffing is good. It's jazz. You got to like jump in and be like da 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 da, and add to it versus stopping it or changing the tempo until you're so good at knowing what the tempo is, then you can, you know, change it. But yeah, just kind of like constantly be adding little notes. And
don't take too long to order lunch, because there's always one guy in every room and it's always super annoying. Am I right?
Forget it.
There's always one person and then lunch is there at like 2. Don't be that guy. It's important. You'll learn
you
this.
I'll order lunch at 10:30.
I've ordered for tomorrow already. You guys, I must have some questions for these folks. They're all very learned. Yes. Get your hands off.
I have a question for Gary and for Vina. Quick separate question.
No offense, you guys.
For Gary, in the first season of Justified, it felt like there was more one-off episodes and less mythology. I mean, there was still the mythology. Yes. And this year is more mythology, but there's still a couple. I would love to know how that's decided and if the network pushes back and says, no, we need more one-offs and how that worked out. And shall I wait and do my Vina question after? And the Vina question is just going from Cold Case to a cable show, I'm assuming a much smaller staff. And it's also a remake of a show. How did you dole out episodes? How was it working with a smaller staff? And what kind of stuff did you read to staff people? Because it's not a procedural, so that's that.
Yeah, I think Unjustified, it was a learning curve, you know? I mean, I think when we first came in, Graham's original concept for the show, I think, was to have one-offs, you know, more procedural, like there would be caper every... and then it was literally, you know, a response from our viewers that told us... what they were craving. And so we listened to it. And so when we came back in the second year, we realized what our goal was Boyd, Raylan together, right? And then what was really phenomenal about this season was that we created that family, you know, Mags and the boys, the Bennett boys. And we realized that as soon as we got our first dailies back from Margot Martindale, which I'm so proud of her, she did an amazing job this season. And when we got those jellies back, we thought, oh my God, we have to spend lots more time with them, right? And that little girl, she's amazing. So then that became like, okay, that's our A story, definitely all the time, you know? And then our B story became the caper, one every 3 episodes. And it's very hard in that show because it had, you know, federal marshals do very limited things. And so we had to really, you know, sparse that out. You know, we had the pregnant fugitive and we had the octogenarian, and then we placed them on the board, and then we sort of weave in all that mythology. But we realized going into the second season where the gold was, and that was our main characters pointing them at each other and developing those interpersonal relationships.
The network was always
1,000%. I have to say that FX is a great place to develop. They believe, John Landgraf really believes in supporting the auteur and, you know, Graham's vision, even if he, you know, differentiated, you know, different from it a little bit at what times, always backs the creator. That's a great place to work.
So the question was difference, Cold Case,
small
killing.
Small staff, and how you build out the episodes,
yeah.
And remakes, and constantly follow the story.
Yeah. Well, we did, it was starting, as far as the original, it was taking the bones of that, the foundation of the original, from literally the pilot. And then as time goes on and as days unfold, you know, making it different. And as far as just the mechanics of the staff, it was a smaller staff, but it was a short, it was a 13 order episode versus 24 in Cold Case. And then the other difference was we spent, and it was such a different animal because it's a serialized show, that in Cold Case, again, you come in 2 weeks, these are stories, pitch, pitch, pitch. This is what's happening with the characters, our cops, not that much. So, you know, we don't have to spend too much time doing it. But in The Killing, we literally said, I had half the staff watch the original and half the staff not watch it. So they came, we all came in, and I didn't want people to come in with preconceived notions. And like what you had said, there were signposts along the way that we knew potentially we could hit and we might hit, but let's, because it's a day per episode, let's just sit in these people's shoes. So what does it, we went to the morgue, we did a ton of research, we hung out with parents who had lost their children who were very, very generous in giving us their time. And instead of saying these are our preconceived notions of what a parent would go through or what a cop would go through or what a politician would go through, let's just bring in the world and then sit in a room and say, what would I do today? Like, what's the first thing you do when you get the call? You go to the morgue, you know, all of that. So that process was much, was so rich. And so it was longer too. It was about a month of sitting in the room and saying, what if, what if, what if? And then going to, and then assigning scripts and then writing.
Just want to add to Vina's thing that on your show this year, you feel that history and that research that those you did, because the relationship between Brent and Michelle, you know, is so great, and you feel the great loss in the kids when they want to know that scene where the kids say, you know, where is she? Want to come back? Tell us the truth. You know, it's just the details. It seems very honest.
Oh, it's brutal. Other questions?
I just had a question. You worked in the animated realm and not so much. And just sort of the differences between, I guess, the processes and approaching, like what is considered to be not so much over the top, but just, you know, something that's broached a little more in the animated world over something that's, you know, like a typical sitcom, you know, with sets that you're going to come back to every week and stuff. And so I guess my question is there like a holding back in your process of stuff where it's like, no, this might be too much, you know, because there's shows nowadays like 30 Rock or Community that are going a little more over the top. But if you're – sorry, this is such a –
No, I understand what you're saying. Yeah, I think I can address it. You obviously have more of a license in animation and The Simpsons and American Dad and I know Family Guy and all that than you ever do, because you have a whole world you can just create automatically. And for some reason, you can accept racism, all homophobia, everything that is un-PC on television, you can do in these shows, obviously. And it's crazy because, you know, my favorite show growing up as a kid, when I was a kid, was All in the Family, you know, and you will never see a character like that anymore, ever. And it's such a tragedy because he was just the greatest character ever. But you only have those characters or those people who can say these things now in animation. So the license is huge. It was, I hate to keep bringing up Third Rock because I've had half of my career since Third Rock, but the beauty of Third Rock was you could always say that these people were aliens. They didn't know the world and they didn't know what they were saying was wrong. And you could always argue with the network.
That's what I say about my grandma when she's
exactly, that's exactly right.
She doesn't know.
And you could get away with that these people all had Alzheimer's. And and that was a beauty and freedom of writing Third Rock, because they could say anything they wanted and it was acceptable. And they said some very un-PC things. And it was wonderful. That was a living cartoon. That was as close to a living cartoon as I've ever written for.
I'm going to take two more questions after this, and we're not leaving until I get two more.
I actually responded to something Bob said about those first 13 Third Rocks and how freeing it was not to have to listen to an audience. And I think since then, particularly with the internet, there is so much more of a sense of people constantly responding to the work you're doing, even as you're doing it. And I'm wondering, I'd like to hear from all of you about to what extent do you take that in and to what extent do you disregard it?
As television impresario Jeff Greenstein.
Jeff, by the way, is the first person who hired me on staff. Really? Uh-huh. Jeff hired me in 1992 on Dream On, and we've become such close friends and co-writers on a couple things. But if you don't mind if I say one story about Jeff, I've got to say a story.
Tack this onto your episode.
What drove me into what allowed me to come into the business was the spec Larry Sanders that I had written in the very first year of Larry Sanders, where only two episodes had been aired. And I was working at Amblin doing coverage on director's reels. And I got a couple director's reels of Todd Hollins, who had directed Larry Sanders' show, and they had never aired, and this show had just aired. And I wrote a Larry Sanders very quickly, and it got me my agent, and within 2 months, I was offered a job on Larry Sanders from the spec script, which never happens. And I met with Gary Shandling and other people on the show that will remain unnamed. And when I went there, I was literally a kid. And I was like, oh, God, oh, yeah, you get up, right, yeah. And it was the rudest meeting I still to this day had ever taken. I was pitching ideas, and one of the head writer was, his back was turned towards me, and he was putting balls into the wall. And another writer was staring out the window, and it was just devastating. And I left. I'll never forget this. I left.
Be nice.
Yes, no, it was. Need. It was nothing. No, and I left. And I went to my car. And I started crying, because my entire life I had wanted to be in the business, writing now for comedies, and this is what I thought the television industry was. By the time I got home, I had already received an offer on the show, and to be a staff writer. It was my first job as on sitcoms. And I said to my agents, you know, I knew that I had a meeting at Dream On the following week. And I said to my agents, you know what? I'm going to wait to accept this offer, because I have this meeting at Dream On, and I want to see, because I, in my head, could not imagine writing with and for those people. And I never seen Dream On. It was in its fourth season. It did not have the buzz. It had quadruple the ratings that Larry Sanders did on HBO, but it didn't have the buzz. It just was just a show. And I watched the show. I liked the show. And I went in to pitch what I thought was just a freelance assignment the following week to Jeff and his partner, Jeff. And the minute I walked in there, it was everything that I expected the industry to be. It was the absolute categorical opposite. And I left there having hope for the business. Literally, again, by the time I got home, I got an offer not to do a script, but to be on staff. And I told my agents, that's where I have to be. And it's this no asshole rule.
Yeah, you know? Jeff is the hero.
It's
of
this
nice.
No asshole rule. I just can't stand to be around assholes and people who make you feel less than you are. You know, I do that enough to people. I don't need people to do that to
done
me.
Done here tonight.
Yes, exactly. So that is just a story. My friendship for Jeff, but also the way I've dealt with the whole business. You really just want to be hopefully in rooms with people you love, and pick not necessarily what's the most buzzed about or money. Every time I do that, I fail. Every single time. Unequivocally fail. When I pick what I know from my gut is the people I want to work with and the show I want to work for, always, always success comes from that. Even if it's not a success, I always end up working with those people. And the career, it gives you a career and not just the moment of buzz. So that's my advice.
Does that answer your question? did you get the attention you wanted?
Yeah. What was your question, was you asshole?
It was about the internet. I remember it. And I've never... Well, his question was about, you know, how are we affected by the message boards? Is that it? And the fan reactions? Yeah. And I can answer, I have no idea, because I've never been on a hit enough show that the message boards go crazy enough. And I'm serious. Parenthood's the first thing I've written on that's really gotten a lot of buzz. But our fan boards, which I try to not watch, but it's hard not to. But ours are all autistic parents talking about how much the show means to them and gives them hope and joy.
The parents are autistic?
Did I phrase that wrong? Did I stutter? The parents of autistic children.
That's good.
Yes. Or children with autism, you have to say, because now it's not PC to say. You can't even say autistic anymore, but I guess
you can in animation. Yeah,
I was about to make that joke. Yeah. Fuck. That's why I can't be in a comedy room. Not only do you have to make the joke, you have to make it fast. So my answer is no, I don't really.
You guys must have had some vocal fans on The Middleman.
We did.
That was a real niche kind of cult show.
That was a show that we wrote in such a vacuum because we wrote most of the episodes before it really started airing. And so by the time the fan boards were going crazy, we were like breaking episode 11 at that point. So we didn't pay attention to those people. But we appreciated everything they said.
On Justified, when we came back our second season, it had gotten a really good reception. And they had looked at the fans and saw what they were saying. And it actually coincided with sort of Graham's vision for the show, which was pretty awesome. And so that's the only way that it affected us. It sort of just confirmed his sort of vision. It was like, yeah, we're moving in the right direction.
I don't read the boards at all because I'm terrified of what people are going to say. The only thing I read were some of the reviews. And then I don't know if you felt this way on The Shield or if you guys felt this way on your shows, but it started to feel like reading anything started to become heroin. Like you were just like getting too into it, and then you were too vulnerable to it. So whereas before, like with Third Rock or your show, is we had the space and the silence of just us and kind of being like, is this good? Is this interesting? We like it. We like the story we're telling. And then all of a sudden, all these people are weighing in, and you're just like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. And then the minute someone says something, even a tiny bit mean, you're just crying and on the floor and oh my God, I hate myself and I'm terrible and this is all a failure. And I was just like, I can't, like this is like a roller coaster. It's awful. It affects you so much.
I actually believe that the writers of the show understand what's working and what's not working. I really do believe that. I don't think they need to be told by the public. I think it's wonderful that the public can chime in and definitely you get a sense of what they like, but it's usually what I think the staff likes themselves. Mm-hmm. You feel a show going off in the wrong direction when you're on the staff and you try to rein it back. I don't know if you need, and it is heroin. It is. I remember when Samantha Who started, I was, and it's ridiculous. It's silly.
And it's hard enough anyway.
It is hard enough.
Because you get it from, there's the message boards and then there's Joe Public. And you're like, well, I work on the show. And they're like, well, you know what I think. And then there's the pitch and you should really do this story and your casting is not so good. And what's up with the hair? And it's just like, oh my God.
Can I tell my favorite review story, though?
I wish you would. I was just about to ask.
Sarah,
do you have a favorite review story?
Because reviews are always so painful and awful, but I was in Vegas for a weekend, the weekend that People Magazine happened to randomly review the Sci-Fi Channel movie I wrote, and they reviewed it as dumb but fun. And so I proceeded to get hammered in Vegas at a bachelorette party and tell everyone that I was dumb but fun, and I proved. I did very well for myself that night.
Any other questions?
We've heard on previous panels how difficult it is to get a writing representation. I'm curious when in your career you got representation and what was it that led to that representation?
Anyone can start. I think some of you sort of already answered this because you were working or you were hired and then got representation after that, but
no, I mean, the way I got it when I was in college. I don't actually. The business has changed so much, and representation has changed so much, and there's so many fewer agencies now than there were in 1989 when or 88 when I sent out these letters. But I sent out 160 letters to 160 different agents and said, hi, my name is Bob Cashel. I have a comedy group in Los Angeles. Here's a copy of my my review. And I highlighted every review. And I said, I just wrote a spec, Wonder Years. This is how long ago it was. And it's about this. And if you want to know how it turns out, send me the self-addressed stamped envelope and I'll send you the script. And within a week, I got probably 98% of them were no's, but thank you. And 8 of them said yes, they'd like to read the spec. And then within a week of that, 2 people said they wanted to represent me. It's crazy. God. I don't know, though, if it works that way anymore. And that was one agent. Then I got another agent after that from a completely different – Chris Silverman, who now – like I said, as the president of ICM, who I never talked to, it was a whole different thing. And it was me again working at Amblin, somebody reading my script at Amblin, sending it to their friend who said that they would send it to, this is true, send it to their friend, and that friend happened to be the girlfriend at the time of a junior agent at Broder, and that was Chris. And he read it, and I was his first client, and he was what I like to say my first big agent. So,
yeah, mine was a friend of a friend thing too. And I got in on the feature side because this is back, you know, before I had done anything. And so I had written a feature spec. And so a friend of a friend sent it to some guy he knew at Broder. And so he really loved the feature sample. And I said, well, I really want to write TV. And so they brought in, like, they wheeled in like their lowest level TV agent and like just stuck him in the meeting. And then it's funny because like that agent and I have now had this like incredible 10-year growth and relationship together. And that feature agent, you know, left long ago. And I've had no success on the feature side. Other than dumb but fun.
My first agent, I was, again, it was about being, I was ignorant. I was doing plays, and I didn't know that you weren't supposed to call up the head of ICM.
Yeah.
During that period of time, it was in the 80s, I was in New York. I was a waiter for 7 fucking years. 2 years at the Odeon, 5 years at Café Luxembourg, and I could serve America fucking dinner. And I was putting up my plays, and I was, and I used to wait on all these very famous people all the time. And I was, you know, I just really loved what I did. And I was doing a little play at this Cabiculo Theater on 51st between 9th and 10th. And I, you know, Sam Cohn, who was, you know, legendary ICM agent, used to come in all the night for dinner and stuff like that. And so I was putting in my play, and I thought, I'm going to get that motherfucker in my theater. And so I called ICM, and I was like, Sam Cohn, please. And they were like, who's calling? I was like, Gary Lennon. No, I'm sorry, I didn't say Gary Lennon. This is how I got in. I was like, Rupert Pupkin. And he was like, who? And I was like, Rupert Pupkin. And that was the guy from The King of Comedy, yeah. You know? And so all of a sudden I got, hello? True story. But this is added to the thing was that I was doing a play with this girl who I'm currently, who's actually ironically producing my next play. Her name is Alicia Hogue. Her name now is Alicia Adams. But her mother is Alice Arlen, who wrote Silkwood with Nora Ephron. And she happened to be in my play. And it was so funny because at the opening of my play was this trash can, this girl getting screwed behind the trash can. And she was like, Gary, my mother's coming tonight. Do I have to do Doggy Style? I was like, absolutely. And anyway, she got Alicia's mom, Alice, came to see my play, and she brought friggin' Sam Cohn. And long story short was he was very generous at the end of the play. He said, you should be working. And I said, I know. And he, his son winded up buying my play and then doing it as a film called Drunks. And it's with like Faye Dunaway and all ICM clients. Diane Weese. And that was sort of my entree into the world. But you know what? I want to say to all of you, because I really believe this, because I was that kid who didn't have any relationships in the business or anything like that. And didn't, as I said, graduate high school. That's why I believe everyone can do this. But and I believe that other people want to help. So that was a writer extended her hand to me, Alice Arlen, and I never forget that. And so other writers, I believe writers want to help other writers. So, you know, go out there and try to get your stuff read.
Yeah, well, my story isn't very interesting. Basically, I had just gotten staffed through the Disney thing on Push Nevada, and then all of a sudden, all the agencies were like, oh my God, who is this person, and why did they get staffed without us? And so it was dinners and drinks and drunkenness, and that's how I got my first agent.
That's the easy way to get an agent.
But, by the way, I also believe that if you have an agent, it doesn't mean you sit back and do nothing.
Yeah.
They do nothing except they do so much. They really do, but you really have to be a part of it. You really have to be a part of it. I texted Christina Applegate about the show that she's on this year. I sent Way to Go myself to John Plowman in England, who was a contact that I had made myself. You know, through various things. It's just you've got to play your cards too. You can't just sit back and let somebody else do it. I think that happens a lot, and I don't think it works.
One other just piece of advice is I think agents are really happy with clients like yourself or who are always generating new material because, you know, an agent hates the idea when you call them up and you're like, what's happening? Deadly. But if you, I see like writing a new script as a gift, and you're actually writing it, giving it to someone, and inviting all these incredible people to your party. And so always look to create new business opportunities for yourselves by creating new scripts, because that's what they love. They love clients who create new material all the time because it makes their job easier.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it goes a long way. And I think we talked about this last time, when you can do so much of this networking on your own. You know, so much of this business is knowing the right people at the right time and then having the right material ready. You know, and an agent or a manager will appreciate that too. What are you watching on TV these days? What do you love? Just go down the
Justified.
Line. Well, sure.
Oh, Game of Thrones and Real Housewives of Orange County are on against each other, and that's devastating to me.
Wow. Good one, though. Yeah. Honestly, AMC, Breaking Bad, Mad Men, The Killing. I still like Dexter, Justified, and Mob Wives.
I ironically, I don't watch any comedy. It's Mad Men. What did you say?
Breaking Bad.
Breaking Bad, which awesome. I think is... I have not seen The Killing yet. I have it on TiVo. I will be watching it. I really do. Breaking Bad, I think, is one of the greatest shows of all time. Ever. Well,
but you've seen The Wire, right?
Totally.
I have not. I have not seen The Wire. I know. I'm told this every day.
I get a lot of shit about it, too. It's like
I've got to do it.
Get the DVD.
Everyone tells people, I'll send them to you.
I would have brought them tonight.
My father, I introduced my dad and mother to to Breaking Bad. And my father passed away in June. And I said to him a couple of weeks before he passed away, I said, "Do you have any regrets?" And he said, "Yeah, I got one regret. I'm not going to see season 4 of Breaking Bad." That is the absolute truth. And, you know, obviously, you know, that's how much he loved the show. And I was able to tell Vince Gilligan that, who created the show, and it just knocked him dead. I mean, he died. That's why Vince died, which is a shame. But, it's all drama. And Game of Thrones, which I'm not sure I like. Do I like it? I don't know why I'm watching it.
It's like Lord of the Rings with extremely graphic sex. What's not to like?
The sex isn't that graphic.
Both parts of that you said.
The sex is not that graphic.
No.
It's not graphic enough. I want to see some good medieval sex, and I'm not seeing it. I'm seeing people kill dogs. I'm seeing things I don't necessarily need to see. So, I don't know.
Vina, you're watching Game of Thrones.
I'm not. No, I'm,
good
I'm
for
going
you.
To, though. 30 Rock. I was watching Community, which is a great show.
It is great.
Huge Breaking Bad, fanatic Breaking Bad fan. Not a lot of time to watch, but my guilty pleasures are Intervention and Real Housewives.
Yes. My guilty Atlanta.
Oh, what were you saying? Atlanta. I was just saying I watch American Idol.
Yeah.
Big American Idol fan.
It's fine. All right. Hilarious network notes. So that'll be our last question.
I have a funny standards and practice note. On The Middleman, we had a situation where we had a duck get stuck in a warp hole, as ducks are prone to do, like flying through the thing. And so we were going to be shooting the, like, you could see the side that was like in our reality, but not that was in like the alternate universe. So it was like half a duck and shooting from behind. And so we got this big, like, legal note asking us to ensure that we did not show the butthole of the duck, which led to like a really long conversation about, like, does a duck have a visible butthole? Like, where is the butthole? So then,
who had to Google that?
So, oh, we totally made our writer's assistant. She printed out, like, page after page. We're looking at, like, we're Googling, like, duck butthole. And then, so, of course, when the duck wrangler shows up with the duck, all the whole writing staff is, like, drunk. And then she's like, "What are you doing?" We're like, "Just don't worry about it. Just, yeah." That was a weird one. And no, you can't see the butthole of the duck.
Wait, do they have a butthole, though?
Well, the poo comes out somewhere.
The standard of practice, that's always the funny standard of practice notes, far funnier than network or studio notes. But that I don't remember what show it was, but they wouldn't allow us to say D-bag, but they would allow us to say douchebag.
We weren't allowed to say D-bag. Oh, we actually got a network note saying we can't say D-bag because it's short for douchebag. And we wrote back saying, "No, it's short for dirtbag." And they said, "Oh, okay."
good. Clever. We just use douchebag.
Well, good. Then we're done. thank you guys so much. First of all, thanks to A26LA. Visit their website, a26la.org. They're always looking for volunteers and for your money. Thanks to everyone here at Nerdist Industries at Meltdown Comics, especially Ed, who is back there paying close attention to every word we said. Give my guests a round of applause. Sarah Watson, Gary Lennon, Bob Cruchel, and Vina Sood. We'll see you next week. Now go home and watch The Killing.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.